This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. I have three children, and they love to read. My wife spends quite a bit of time looking for quality books for them to make sure they're putting good, educational, worthwhile material into their minds. The other day, I saw a book on the desk of one of my daughters, and the title caught my eye. It said, Breaking Stalin's Nose. There was a comment on the very top of the cover. It said, an important book for all people living in free society. And then turning it over on the back, it said, all Sasha wants is to become a young Soviet pioneer until his father is taken. This is all very intriguing. I've been doing some reading on communism and really coming to see more of just what this ideology is really about, how dangerous it is. And this is a short novel for young people. I picked it up and I read it. I wasn't able to put it down. The book doesn't take all that long to read, but it's an excellent little book. I got in touch with the author. His name is Eugene Yelchin. He was born in Russia in 1956, and he grew up with a communist father. He has since moved to Los Angeles, where he's primarily known as an artist. He's done work for HBO and Coca-Cola, Paramount Pictures. He's also illustrated a number of children's books. But he's written some children's books, and for Breaking Stalin's Nose, in 2012, he received the Newbery Honor, the Washington Post's Best Children's Book of the Year, a whole bunch of other awards, very well-deserved. Today, he is our special guest on Trumpet Hour. He was very willing to talk about his experiences living under communism, what caused him to become disillusioned, and why he moved away from Russia. We talked about his book, and I think my favorite part of the interview is when I read him a couple of passages that he wrote and just ask him to comment on them. I found our conversation extremely interesting, and I hope that you will as well. So that's going to take up most of the program today. But I realize that communism isn't a subject we tend to be too concerned about today, so I want to just set the table a little bit by talking about a powerful article that appears in the newest edition of the Trumpet Magazine that gives some important perspective on this subject. And I'm going to finish the program with a few more thoughts about that and specifically talk about the difference between socialist government, which is really just a watered-down version of communism, and the biblical model for government. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. In the May-June 2017 edition of the Trumpet Magazine, trumpet writer Andrew Miller has an article titled The World's Most Powerful Weapon. And it's not about nuclear bombs or other weapons of mass destruction. It's actually about the idea that is behind nuclear bombs and so many of the other problems that we see in the world today. It's the idea that has become deeply entrenched in our modern world that actually now has come to enjoy the benefit of having the legitimacy or being synonymous with scientific, rational thought, and that is the idea that there is no God. Now, this is an idea with radical implications. This is from Andrew's article. He wrote, those who follow the Christian ideology believe that morality is God's definition of right and wrong. Those who follow the evolutionary ideology believe that morality is actually an invention of the human mind. Therefore, logically, the human mind can alter the definition of right and wrong at will, because the human mind is the authority that made up right and wrong in the first place. So you accept the evolutionary model, or you accept a world without God, you accept creation with no creator, and morality goes out. Right and wrong go out. Everything is relative. So at the founding of America, where the founders said, and they wrote in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, if there's no creator, then these rights are actually endowed by human beings. So they're not unalienable. Human beings gave them. Human beings can take them away. Well, where does that leave you? It takes you to some really dangerous places. This is also a quote from Andrew's article. In a world where God is a myth and there is no absolute morality, the most powerful force in the universe is the human mind. Thus, instead of trying to limit the power of government in order to protect your and my individual rights that are endowed by our Creator, atheists often try to get control of governments and to expand their power to the point that they can use them to end war, end poverty, end suffering. Now, that sounds great, right? I mean, who wants war or poverty or suffering? Who wouldn't want to end those horrible things? But as Andrew says, and just to go on with the quote from his article, this is the logic that led to the totalitarianism of communist Russia. I'm going to return to this thought at the end of the program today, but I want to encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com and read this article. Again, it's called The World's Most Powerful Weapon. You can search for that on the website. But I'd like to go now to the interview, and I think this conversation really does illuminate this subject in some interesting ways. This is my conversation with artist and author Eugene Yelchin. How much do you know about communism? Our guest today knows a lot about it. His name is Eugene Yelchin. He was born and educated in Russia. He grew up in a communal apartment. His father was a devoted communist, and he accepted communist ideals. But as he grew up, he began to question those beliefs. In 1983, when he was 27 years old, he left the Soviet Union and immigrated to the United States. In 2011, he published Breaking Stalin's Nose. This is a short middle grade novel that tells the story of a boy growing up under the rule of Joseph Stalin. And this book does a marvelous job of showing a side of communism, the effects of communism on the people who live under this system in a way that even children can understand. We have him via Skype from Los Angeles, California. Hello, Eugene.
Hello, Joel. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. So the story in the book, this boy, he grows up, his greatest dream is to join the young Soviet pioneers. He wants to devote his life to being a vigilant communist. But then some things happen that kind of break the spell and that cause disillusionment to set in. And it seems like the basic arc of the story is somewhat similar to what you experienced in your own life. Maybe you can just tell us a bit about your own experiences and how maybe they parallel that.
Well, the parallel between the narrative in the book and the narrative of my own life is emotional, not factual, because mm-hmm. the book is set during the Stalinist purges, the worst period of Stalinist rule. I was born 3 years after his death. Mm-hmm. I was born in 1956, and at that point, the country slowly began to move away from the kind of violence that was prevalent under Stalin, and yet what remained, and I believe still remains to some extent, is the fear of that violence, is the fear of being wrongly accused, of being put to prison, of being put in front of the firing squad. Every family in Russia has, and I truly believe that, every family in Russia has a history of some kind of oppression that they experienced over the period of 70 years. Living with that fear becomes a norm. And so when I grew up, I didn't know that was a norm. I did not know that was, you know, seeing my parents whispering and never speaking out and being afraid of expressing your opinions was a normative behavior. So as you know, in order to survive an environment that's dangerous, one creates a certain set of defense mechanisms within oneself. And so what you do, you shut down your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take a certain amount of dramatic events in your life in order to even become aware of those defenses, of shutting down your emotions, of blindly believing in some concept that is not yours but was passed on to you. And so in that respect, there's a parallel between the character in the book and my own journey.
So your father was a communist, but he also, it seemed that he had some reservations about it. And it seems like you, I guess, how much do you identify maybe with the nationalistic spirit that the boy has at the beginning of the book? And what were some of the experiences that you had that began to make you feel like, well, wait a minute, there's more to this than what I'm recognizing?
Well, my father was a communist since World War II, and he was fairly young at that time, and I think he was a highly intelligent person and could see the difference between the propaganda that we were fed continually and what was actually happening in reality. But the problem with, and to me personally, a problem with belonging to a certain particular, to a certain political party, is that you don't have a personal responsibility. At least that was the case with the Communist Party. You were part of the big machine. You knew that that machine was committing crimes, but you never, instead of questioning the whole premise of it, you would point your finger to that or that individual that made, as what they said about after Stalin's death, committed mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And those mistakes cost that country millions of human lives. But the party could never be wrong. And my father truly believed that the party could never be wrong. And it wasn't something that one could argue with him. But as I reached my kind of teenagehood years, coincided with the for the first time under the Soviets, there was a dissident movement in the mid-70s, early to mid-70s, late 60s really, to mid-70s. And so what I was able to do is something that I couldn't do with my dad. I was able to read books that were smuggled into the country or retyped secretly and passed around, which called Some Is That, which literally means self-publishing. So they would take, for example, a copy of Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago, and on a home typewriter would type multiple copies of it with a carbon paper, right? It's before the computers.
Wow.
And so those kind of, you know, those, I remember what they felt like in my hands reading those things. And you can only read them overnight, and somebody would give them these books to you, like Solzhenitsyn, even like some of the poets that were never published. So there was always a danger of the person who gave you the book was an informer, because you never really knew who the informers were, right?
So they could actually be baiting you.
Very possibly. So if you were to arrest it with that kind of literature in your possession, you would probably go to the prison, to camp, to whatever. So you were risking your life, essentially, in order to find out the history of your own country and to read literature that was not allowed by the Soviet censorship. And that's where that split occurred between my father's beliefs and my beliefs. I just glimpsed it from books.
You know, it. I read somewhere they where it's been said that Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago was the most important book of the 20th century. and just listening to you talk and just how the effect that maybe him breaking the silence on some of his own experiences. And I know that he wrote that book in pieces and at great danger to himself, and was smuggling pieces of it out of the country and so on. The effect that it had on the West in opening people's eyes to what was really happening over there was certainly tremendous. It's interesting to hear your experience and encountering some of that literature from within the system. You mention there's a little note at the end of Breaking Stalin's Nose where you talk about how that fear that you were mentioning was retained for years after Stalin died, that it was still kind of seared on the Russian experience, and this book was basically your attempt to deal with that fear. That's really quite extraordinary to just hear your side of that.
Yes, because I feel that the fear that was instilled in the populace during the 1930s, particularly, frankly. Early on, and just to say, you know, I'm not a historian and I'm not a politician. I write books for children. Mm-hmm. So whatever I'm going to tell you is a result of my own personal experience and also my research.
You set the book during, you mentioned basically the worst time under Stalin, the Soviet purges. And so the story of the boy in the book, it takes place in the middle of that where, and I guess you're looking at that as kind of the point at which the worst fears that you were still experiencing later were seared on the people of Russia. Was that the motivation behind the choice that you made there?
Truly the same story could have happened anywhere between, I would say, early 20s, and then 1919, really, when the first terror occurred in that country, mm-hmm. all the way through probably end of Stalin, 1953. Mm-hmm. And I never, I never actually give the exact date in a book. Mm. I never really say exactly what period it is. I think people who are familiar with the Soviet history, they instantly think it's the period of the worst purges, which is 35, 38. But I do believe that 1930s cemented the Soviet character that we are still dealing with today, that it created an individual that by that time, all the institutions that Russia accumulated over, you know, 1,000 years were annihilated and scratched out. And the Russian culture by 1930s was pretty much annihilated or silenced. And so that's the period that we're still dealing with today. And ironically, I think we're dealing with it in Europe and we're dealing it with the United States. And to me, 1930s was a formative period for the beginning of 21st century.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio. This is an interview with Eugene Yelchin, the author of a children's book called Breaking Stalin's Nose. When we return, we're going to talk about the book and a couple of scenes that give some insight into the psychological climate of communism. Please do stick around to hear Mr. Yelchin's insights.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
We'll dive right back into this interview with the author of Breaking Stalin's Nose, Russian author Eugene Yelchin. We're going to start with reading a portion of the book to Mr. Yelchin. There's a point in the book where one of the children gets his glasses cracked, and the the teacher is trying to get to the bottom of what had happened. She asks the kid, and he won't say who it was that caused this to happen. But the teacher says, and I'm just reading this from the book, Finkelstein, the name of the boy, refuses to cooperate with authority, which is me, the teacher. In capitalist countries, the teacher would decide whether to admit Finkelstein back into the classroom or send him to the principal to receive his punishment. But remember, children, the Soviet classroom is the most democratic in the world. You will decide his fate. You will vote. Those in favor of sending Finkelstein to the principal, raise your hands. And all of the kids raise their hands, except for the one who committed the act. And she basically says, well, if you're not going to vote, she looks at him and says, I may have to withdraw my request that you get this honor. We don't allow those who vote against the majority to handle the sacred banner. So there's this coercion behind it. There's the pretense of democracy, but not actually anything democratic about it.
Well, that's right. There are several things that are happening simultaneously in that scene. One is we lived under the complete barrage of propaganda, that we lived in the most democratic place in the world, that we were fighting for peace. It was very obviously anti-capitalist philosophy, Marxist philosophy that we had to study, and anti-Western sentiment that kind of historically inherited to Russia, but was used and enforced under the Soviets. So one of the themes of that particular scene is this kind of propaganda that the teacher imparts to her students as a kind of a speaking tool of the government. There's another theme in there that is a little bit subtler. Finkelstein is Jewish. I'm Jewish. I was the only Jew in my school. So I felt anti-Semitism very, very strongly on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. I never in the book mention it. So there are several remarks from the teacher that are highly anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. but the main character never comments on it because it is a norm. It is a given. It is the environment that they live in. Right. So there are other themes in this book, because it also, in this scene, is that it also deals with this issue of the individual and the collective. Mm-hmm. The kind of individual that could speak for himself or herself, that had her or his own thoughts, views on life, unthinkable. In the Soviet Union, you were part of the collective, and if you were any different, you were in danger of being ostracized. Mm-hmm. So that is what she's doing. She said, if you are going to be different than everyone else, you will suffer. And the kind of tension between the individual and the collective is shot through this entire book. And yes. That was true of my own life as well. Yeah. Because not only I was Jewish, I was also an artist, and artists tend to be outsiders. So the whole experience is viewed from the outsider's point of view.
Yeah, that is really fascinating, the tension between the collective and the individual. And you see that several places throughout the book. Another scene that really struck me was you talk so much about spying and how important it is for a communist to be vigilant, and you're essentially this idea that that capitalists are kind of crawling all over the place, and that they're infiltrating the school, and that the biology teacher is actually a spy, that this creates this sense of you always have to have your eyes looking around to see anything that's suspicious. And it kind of turns people against one another in very destructive ways. And I think the scene that really brought this out remarkably was where there's this apparent crime that has been committed, and the teacher is trying to get to the bottom of this. And let me see here. She says, "Now take out your pencils. On a new sheet of paper, write down the names of the pupils in our class whom you suspect might be responsible. When finished, sign and date your list in the upper right corner and pass it to the front." Nobody moves. The teacher says, "Children, why are we not writing?" "We're not sure." And this one student speaks for everybody. "Well, how can you not be sure, Zena? Did you do it?" "No." "Well, do you think your friend Tamara did it?" She looks at Tamara. "No, she doesn't think she could." "See, Zena, it's simple. You know who didn't do it. I'll make it easy for you. Write down the names of the pupils who you're sure didn't do it." So she starts scribbling away. She can think of a lot of people that she thinks didn't do it. And the teacher says, "Just keep writing. Just make sure you're right. Do you know what will happen if even one name on your list turns out to be unreliable? You yourself will be suspected. We will know that Zena Krivko is covering for the enemies of the people." And suddenly she can't think of any names
to put down
on the list.
That's correct. And that is exactly, and that was the policy. That was a very conscious policy of the state, is to isolate people, to separate them from each other, to break, as I said earlier, to break the institutions that existed prior to them. Family was one of them, friendship. All those things that we take for granted were suspect. For example, during that period, an enormous amount of denunciations was written by people about other people, denouncing them, telling them that they suspect them of being spying for the foreign powers. All of those letters went to the secret police, and each one of them was taken seriously, even though they were anonymous. Each anonymous letter was taken seriously and was investigated, and usually they would find fault. The one thing that bothered them is when such a letter would come from a group of people. That really worried them, because they didn't want people grouping up. Stalin had his own, personal psychotic qualities, but that aside, the governmental policy was such that would turn a person against person, because that would be the environment that you can control them so much better, so much easier. And that kind of mistrust of the people even near to you remain with them now, I believe, with some of them, perhaps not with the younger generation, but with those who went through the Soviet Union or were born during the Soviet years. I think they inherited that mistrust.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio. This is an interview with Eugene Yelchin about his children's book called Breaking Stalin's Nose. It's a book that really gives some insight into the tools that can be used by a totalitarian state in order to maintain its power over people. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, Mr. Yelchin will share his thoughts on today's Russia.
Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Back to the interview with Russian-born author Eugene Yelchin. We were talking before we started the interview just about the contrast between what happened in Germany after World War II and what happened in Russia at the end of the Soviet era. that in Germany you had this very, and that Solzhenitsyn talks about this in the Gulag Archipelago, that the Germans went to extreme lengths, apparently, just looking at the situation on the surface, the Nuremberg trials. They really tried to publicly atone for the sins that they committed in World War II. You never saw anything quite like that in Russia. In fact, it was just maybe a couple dozen people who were convicted of war crimes after, as you said, dozens of millions had been killed. Nobody knows the number for sure because so much was in secret and so much was covered up and never revealed. But there was never the working through the problem. And Solzhenitsyn said basically it's a cancer in the heart of the state that has never been purged. It's there to this day. Of course, he was writing, you know, maybe 20 years ago. But it does make you look at Russia today and ask, as you see the kinds of tactics that Putin is using, even though it's not communist, how much, as you look at what's happening in Russia today, do you see the after effects or the, you know, some of the problems that were never dealt with remaining there today?
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, who said that? Napoleon said that victors write history. You know, I don't think Germans would have voluntarily created the Nuremberg trial.
Right.
You know, it was the Allied nations that put it together because they lost the war. The Russians won the war, and so they were the winners, and World War II for them. And the victory in World War II is the cause of enormous nationalistic pride, you know, is a sacred kind of is a sacred kind of notion, particularly in the older generations. Soviet Union just got dissolved, and the people who came to power after in 1991 after Gorbachev. And continued, you know, there were three of them. They could not allow for anything similar to Nuremberg trial simply because they were taking charge, they were in power. So to put it bluntly, the Russia is ran by the KGB operative, you know, by his friends. You know, he worked in the KGB for a long time. He was trained by the machine, and so the tactics that he is using and his government is using now are essentially KGB tactics that were used in 1930s and 1940s and 1950s. And 1960s and on and on and on. That started very early. The problem that I see is that because the seemingly the ideology is lacking at this point, is very difficult to point your finger and at what's happening. And so what we see now is some portion of American politicians and American citizens in conservative parties and the right-wing groups tend to actually praise Russia and establish contacts with them, which is fine in itself. You know, they have common interests and common goals. The problem is that I believe, because the Americans do not know history of Russia in detail, you know, they don't know obviously some of it, but they don't know the minutiae of it, the actual mechanisms, how people were manipulated. And so as a result, I see some of those unions are naive on the American part, because what I think they do not understand is that they are part of much bigger plan and plot. Yes, they may have similar interests, like, for example, NRA and people in Russia who promote, you know, having guns, it's fine. But what the NRA members do not understand, that they also fall into a trap, that they could become, and we saw it just in our election, that they could become a part of much bigger, they can be used, and they don't know how they can be used. And I'm not convinced the Russians know it yet, but they put in the chips, they put in the cars into their deck, you know, they stuck in the deck, because at some point it will be used. And the danger of that clandestine underlining of all the interactions with them, because all the interactions are controlled by essentially KGB.
You know, it's
dangerous.
Yeah, I feel like the more that I learn about communism, the more I feel like I need to know more about communism. And I feel that way about a lot of Americans. You know, the way that the subject of communism in America today, in a lot of ways, I think it's, well, you see two parallel trends, probably. One is there is the ridicule of, say, the effort to purge communism from America under the days of McCarthy. McCarthy is kind of looked at as a cartoon character. And, you know, whatever excesses he may have gone to, that is the focus. And then at the same time, you have politically this a certain amount of romance taking place on the politically and in the academia, where people are looking at communism as something that wasn't all that bad. Maybe there were some problems in the way that it was carried out, but it is a viable economic model that we need to. So you see the rise of, say, the Socialist Party within the United States. What I wonder is, how much do you, well, first of all, like on the cover of your book, there's a quote that says, this is from a critic. It says, "An important book for all people living in free society." And it seems to me like that really is true. I agree with that. It seems like we just don't know enough about what it is that we're dealing with. And so the way that we're associating or that we're warming up to some of these ideas seems like there's a lot of naivety there. I just wonder your perspective in seeing the way that some of those things are being handled today, if it's different, having had the history that you do.
I agree. I think that the naivete is certainly present, but, you know, it's hard to and unfair to expect somebody being really interested in Russian history and in the history of communism in Russia and the history of Soviet Union. The problem I see is that we ourselves as Americans do not know our own history of the period. Because in the 1930s in this country, the division between the right wing and the left wing was quite severe, but the choice was clear as well. It was either fascism, it was either Nazi Germany or Soviet Union. So the academia and the intellectuals and some of the creative workers, they tend to become left-wing thinkers because they couldn't identify with the Nazi Germany. That became problematic because when the news from the Soviet Union started to become apparent, that there are tremendous atrocities and human sacrifices occurring daily there, the academia and the intellectuals, they first of all, they didn't believe it. Mm-hmm. Or they felt like they couldn't believe it. Because again, they, you know, the choice was very clear. And if we don't know that history, if we don't know what happened in the 1930s, right before World War II in America, it's very difficult to understand what's happening now, because a very similar thing is happening now. We are still fighting between what are we going to do? Are we going to make a union with Russians who are just as aggressive and Putin now become, you know, the man of the moment, because it seems that his country is the most stable country in Europe. Mm. You know, while we look at European elections and look at American elections,
right?
But he has a hand in it, and
Right. It's hard not to look at Russia today. If you see the trajectory of Russian power, say, from the time of Gorbachev to now, and you see, well, this man actually made this country relevant again. You know, there definitely is a case to be made for, you know, he's done some amazing things. And yet, when you look at the tactics and you think about the history and you think about how some of the political ideas that he's espousing, and it seems like, I guess more specifically, the fact that people in many countries, including the United States, seem to be growing more comfortable with the idea of a more authoritarian state, handing more power over to the individual at the top. It seems like in some ways that is the most concerning thing about it, that we're comfortable with this in a way that we weren't a couple of generations ago.
That's correct. And I think that we paint exactly for what happened a couple of generations ago. I think this is still a rollback from the 1960s, very much. But as I said, you know, I'm not a historian. I'm going into territory that I will sound really stupid. I don't want it to happen. I read books for children, and the idea behind the book in question here is for young generation, for young people, young readers now, is you know, to them, Soviet communism is as distant as Spanish Inquisition. It's meaningless to them. But what makes sense to them is something that happens to them daily in the classroom, at their homes, on the play yard, everywhere on the street. It is to stand for what you believe in, for not believing anything blindly, for asking questions, for not seeing yourself through the eyes of others, and for finding your own place, your own integrity in the outside of the collective, outside of the group, and see whether you can enter the group as an individual. And I think that that is an important lesson for kids. And we are seeing some of, as you just described, some of the problems resulting from the lack of that attention to one's personal individual integrity.
It's marvelous to get your perspective. We've been talking with author and artist Eugene Yelchin, the author of the book Breaking Stalin's Nose. Eugene, how can people get in touch with your work if they want to follow you?
Oh, it's very easy. Just EugeneYelchin.com will take him to several websites, to my book website, to I do all kinds of things. I'm a painter, I'm a filmmaker, and I write books and I illustrate books. So EugeneYelchin.com will take them right to where they want to be. It's very easy to contact me if people would want to.
I haven't said anything about the illustrations in the book, but they are extraordinary. They really do enhance the message of the book. I didn't even realize it was the author and illustrator were the same man until after I was done and started thumbing through everything again. But thank you so much for your time, Eugene. It's been tremendous. We really appreciate it.
I'm very happy to be there. Thank you very much.
That was a conversation with Eugene Yelchin. I really enjoyed and appreciate his generosity with his time and with his insights. We're going to finish today's program by looking at an important essay from 1952 that exposes the real heart of communism, and it shows why it's so important we understand this subject, something that might seem irrelevant, but it's actually very relevant in today's world. We'll be right back.
It's time for today's last word.
Alger Hiss was a graduate of Harvard Law School. He worked as a U.S. government official in the 1930s and 1940s. He worked in the Justice Department, in the State Department. He was a United Nations official. Well, he was also a Soviet spy. And a man named Whitaker Chambers, who was a former communist involved in Soviet espionage, testified against Alger Hiss in 1948 and helped to bring this man to justice. In 1952, Whitaker Chambers wrote an autobiography titled Witness. Chambers had come to realize just how spiritually destitute and bankrupt communism is, and he left that system. And in the introduction to his book, Witness, he exposes the heart of the communist ideology in an extremely powerful way. If you can, I'd highly recommend you read it. Chambers called the whole system that was devised by Joseph Stalin, which ended up killing tens of millions of people, nobody knows for sure how many, he called it the inevitable result of Russia's embrace of Darwinist-inspired atheism. I just want to read a couple of excerpts from the introduction to Witness. Whitaker Chambers wrote this: "The revolutionary heart of communism is not the theatrical appeal. Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains. You have the world to gain. It is a simple statement of Karl Marx, further simplified for handy use. Philosophers have explained the world. It is necessary to change the world." He says, "Communists are bound together by no secret oath. The tie that binds them across the frontiers of nations, across barriers of language and differences of class and education, in defiance of religion, morality, truth, law, honor, the weaknesses of the body and the irresolutions of the mind, even unto death, is a simple conviction. It is necessary to change the world. Their power, whose nature baffles the rest of the world, because in a large measure the rest of the world has lost that power, is the power to hold convictions and to act on them. It is the same power that moves mountains. It's also an unfailing power to move men. Communists are that part of mankind which has recovered the power to live or die, to bear witness for its faith. And it is a simple, rational faith that inspires men to live or die for it." Those are interesting comments, and these are people who see problems in the world. They see injustice, they see poverty and suffering, and they want to fix it. But how do you fix it? How do you prevent certain men from accumulating wealth at the expense of other people? How do you eliminate poverty? That's obviously a challenge that has faced mankind throughout our history. Well, men devised a theory that the problem is property. It's property itself, the very concept of ownership. If everyone just lives and works and contributes to the common good, then everyone's going to be provided for. Everyone's going to be prosperous. It's a marvelous, marvelous idea. This was something that was devised by highly intelligent, well-meaning people who wanted to solve problems. They wanted to change the world for the better. And who's to say there's anything wrong with this idea? You know, if you look at the problems of the world and you want to come up with a solution and you have no foundation, no absolutes restricting you or telling you, well, this is right or this is wrong, if you throw out the Bible and you just try to devise an economic and political means of eliminating inequality and social problems, then you can end up with something like communism. And the communists said, you know, we're not going to just talk about it. We're going to do it. We're going to do whatever it takes to bring this system about. Going on in Whitaker Chambers' essay, he said he talked about it as a faith. In fact, this introduction to Witness contrasts. He says that this is actually the great conflict of the 20th century, the war between two irreconcilable faiths, one of them being communism and the other one being freedom. So he says this faith is not new. It is, in fact, man's second oldest faith. Its promise was whispered in the first days of the creation under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall be as gods. It is the great alternative faith of mankind. Like all great faiths, its force derives from a simple vision. Other ages have had great visions. They've always been different versions of the same vision, the vision of God and man's relationship to God. The communist vision is the vision of man without God. It is the vision of man's mind displacing God as the creative intelligence of the world. It is the vision of man's liberated mind by the sole force of its rational intelligence redirecting man's destiny and reorganizing man's life and the world. It is the vision of man, once more the central figure of the creation, not because God made man in his image, but because man's mind makes him the most intelligent of the animals. Copernicus and his successors displaced man as the central fact of the universe by proving that the earth was not the central star of the universe. Communism restores man to his sovereignty by the simple method of denying God. And another quote from this essay by this former communist, Whitaker Chambers. Hence, the Communist Party is quite justified in calling itself the most revolutionary party in history. It has posed in practical form the most revolutionary question in history, God or man. It has taken the logical next step, which 300 years of rationalism hesitated to take, and said what millions of modern minds think but do not dare or care to say. If man's mind is the decisive force in the world, what need is there for God? Henceforth, man's mind is man's fate. This vision is the communist revolution, which, like all great revolutions, occurs in man's mind before it takes form in man's acts. Insurrection and conspiracy are merely methods of realizing the visions. They are merely part of the politics of communism. Without its vision, they, like communism, would have no meaning and could not rally a parcel of pickpockets. Communism does not summon men to crime or to utopia, as its easy critics like to think. On the plane of faith, it summons mankind to turn its vision into practical reality. On the plane of action, it summons men to struggle against the inertia of the past, which, embodied in social, political, and economic forms, communism claims, is blocking the will of mankind to make its next great forward stride. It summons men to overcome the crisis, which communism claims is, in effect, a crisis of rending frustration with the world, unable to stand still, but unwilling to go forward along the road that the logic of a technological civilization points out, communism. This is communism's moral sanction, which is twofold. Its vision points the way to the future. Its faith labors to turn the future into present reality. It says to every man who joins it, the vision is a practical problem of history. The way to achieve it is a practical problem of politics, which is the present tense of history. Have you the moral strength to take upon yourself the crimes of history so that man may at last close his chronicle of age-old senseless suffering and replace it with purpose and a plan? The answer a man makes to this question is the difference between the communist and those miscellaneous socialists, liberals, fellow travelers, unclassified progressives, and men of goodwill, all of whom share a similar vision but do not share the faith because they will not take upon themselves the penalties of the faith. The answer is the root of that sense of moral superiority which makes communists, though caught in crime, berate their opponents with withering self-righteousness. It's remarkable writing from Whitaker Chambers, a former communist, and this is where we end up when there is no God to whom we are accountable, when human reason is God, when rights aren't bestowed by God, but by the state, and they're not unalienable. They can be given and taken at will, even the right to life itself. And the crimes that he's talking about in Stalinist Russia refer to the killing of tens of millions of people that were deemed to be enemies of the state, obstacles on the path to the implementation of the utopia that is that communist vision that he was talking about. I don't think there's any better example than what happened in Soviet Russia of just the depths of depravity to which the human mind can descend when it is the highest authority in the universe. It's really something to look back on. It's history that we need to study to recognize just how dangerous the human mind can be when it is unmoored from the moral absolutes provided by our Creator through his inspired word. And thinking about all this really makes me deeply appreciate that world of absolutes that's codified in the Bible. In it, God actually lays out a wonderful economic system and political system, a system of government that actually works. It's built on a millennial vision of every man under his vine and under his fig tree, where God gives man dominion over the earth. He places a tremendous amount of power and autonomy in the hands of individual families. He gives parents authority over children and preserves and strengthens families through laws of inheritance. He gives very robust laws guaranteeing individual property rights and instructs man to be wise stewards over his property. It was really those laws, that biblical vision, that underpinned American society at the time of its founding. This nation was built significantly on an effort to explicitly try to implement that vision. If you trace it back, you can see biblical roots of a lot of what we call the American dream. It has become perverted since then, but it is really fascinating to go back and look at that history. Sadly, though, America is changing rapidly. More and more Americans are very eager to sacrifice the economic freedoms, the political freedoms that we enjoy in favor of models that are far more authoritarian and models that have failed time and time again. I want to just finish the program by reading you a short list of some of the stark differences between communist and socialist government and the perfect model of government expounded in Scripture. Socialist government creates complacency through wealth redistribution. God's government fosters stewardship through private property ownership. Socialist government takes from the rich to supply the poor and calls it compassion. God's government teaches love by example and inspires both rich and poor to emulate that example of their own will. Socialist government encourages dependency. God's government encourages industry. Socialist government creates discontent and a sense of entitlement. God's government enables man to savor the fruits of his own labor. Socialist government rewards idleness and saps motivation. God's government energizes, ennobles, and arouses ambition. Socialist government tends towards self-satisfaction and mediocrity. God's government demands excellence. Socialist government insulates man from the consequences of his actions. God's government obliges man to be accountable for his own choices. Socialist government strips man of responsibility. God's government prepares man for ever greater capacity, duty, and authority. Socialist government erodes character. God's government is aimed primarily at creating and cultivating character. Socialist government turns citizens into wards of the state. God's government transforms people into sons of God Himself. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Please do go to thetrumpet.com and check out Andrew Miller's article, The World's Most Dangerous Weapon. You can also learn more about God's biblical form of government by reading an article from our archives, A New World Economy. And another great resource is Chapter 7 of the book Mystery of the Ages, called The Mystery of the Kingdom of God. And you can find that under the Literature tab at thetrumpet.com. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I really want to thank my guest today, Eugene Yelchin. Thanks to our staff as well, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from John Kenneth Galbraith. Under capitalism, man exploits man. Under communism, it's just the opposite. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.